I'm Gregory Berg. The following morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2004. Enjoy.
I am very, very happy that for the next few minutes I can speak with best-selling author John Weissman, six times over a New York Times best-selling author, who is responsible for a really thrilling new work of fiction called Jack in the Box, a Shadow War thriller. It is published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. I do not read fiction very much in real life or even in the course of doing this program. Once in a while, I find myself drawn to a particular author and work, and I am so glad that I read Jack in the Box. This is a terrific book, and it takes us right into the heart of the world of intelligence and counterintelligence. And this is something which has interested John Weissman for quite some time. And we're going to be talking about the way in which this is such fertile ground for superb fiction by Weissman and others. And we're grateful that John Weissman can join us for the next few minutes to talk about his career and this particular work. John Weissman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you very much.
You know, it says on the liner jacket that you live with your wife and three dogs in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. It's just kind of interesting to me for me to imagine you in that peaceful, idyllic setting, turning out novels like Jack in the Box.
The lovely thing about the Blue Ridge, Greg, is that while I can see 65 miles from my living room, I can be in Washington in an hour and a half, which allows me to go in and interview sources on a regular basis.
Very good. Tell us, first of all, what you know about the world of intelligence and counterintelligence, and how you've come to know what you know.
Well, I know enough to be afraid, let's put it that way. I think that for the past 20 or so years, with very few exceptions, our intelligence agencies have been led by a succession of non-professionals who have detested the core mission of our intelligence community, which is to spy. And I think that CIA has been led by technocrats for the most part, who have substituted technology for human intelligence. And as I'm fond of saying, it's wonderful to have a satellite that can read a license plate from 22,000 miles in the sky if, that is, you're about to be attacked by license plates. But it doesn't work if you don't have spies that you have recruited and you place them or they have access to terrorist organizations or adversarial governments with rogue nuclear programs or weapons of mass destruction.
One of the things which is touched on, a theme in this book called Jack in the Box, is the idea of these different times in which we live. And you approach that from a couple of different interesting ways. And what I mean is that we are no longer caught in the midst of the Cold War. And it has been suggested by a number of observers that in some ways the intelligence community finds itself sort of stuck in that earlier era of particular enemies that are no longer our enemies or who no longer need to be viewed as our enemies in quite the same way. But you, I think, do not paint the picture that simplistically at all. Tell us a little bit about your view of this particular question.
Well, the CIA tends to have tunnel vision, and there's a reason for that. For almost half a century, CIA devoted just about all its resources to the Soviet Union and to the Soviet Union's clients and surrogates. In 1991, there is no more Soviet Union, and just like Congress and the military, the intelligence community had to refocus itself. What it tends to do is look at one huge problem, and that, to me, is tunnel vision, as opposed to now looking at a broad panoply a larger canvas on which to work. And I think it has affected a lot the way we were taken advantage of for 9/11. I think our adversaries realized that we had tunnel vision. I think our adversaries realized that we were vulnerable and took advantage of it, because the folks at Al-Qaeda and the other Islamist organizations, these are not fools. These are resourceful, dangerous, lethal people with organizations that are very facile at penetrating societies. I mean, they use, for example, the immigration policies of Western Europe to infiltrate cells all throughout Western Europe. They use our immigration laws against us by claiming political asylum, or just by coming to visit relatives or go to school and never leaving. So I think that we have to, as a nation, kind of shift our focus, and that's one of the things I try and get at in Jack in the Box. I mean, if we spend all our time fighting the war on terror, well, we're going to be vulnerable to adversaries who want to penetrate our intelligence community, for example.
We're speaking with John Weissman, and his new book is called Jack in the Box, A Shadow War Thriller. The main character in this book is a very gifted intelligence agent by the name of Sam Waterman. And we follow him through a period in his career which sees some successes and some reversals and so on. But I think, as interesting as anything, we are given a very close and detailed look at the kind of work which someone like a Sam Waterman does on a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis. Tell us a little bit more about how you have developed this know-how for some of these fascinating technical details which go into intelligence work.
I guess the genesis of this is that I have read a fair amount of the literature of espionage fiction, and most of it, I am sorry to say, is junk, because it raises the expectations of what intelligence personnel can do, and it puts them in situations that would never happen in real life. I mean, the idea of the CIA operative, you know, with the guns and the explosives and what have you, they may have firearms training, but basically the most lethal weapon a case officer has is his mind. And It's a mind game that you play as a case officer. You know, you don't go out into dark alleys and necessarily and have these meetings clandestinely late at night. You have them you hide best in the open. You have them at crowded restaurants, at bars where overhearing conversation is nigh on impossible. You have certainly a huge amount of tradecraft, which is the craft of spying. But it's not the kind of Hollywood stuff. I mean, one of the examples I use in Jack in the Box is, in Hollywood, people are always losing their tails, you know, when they're followed.
They realize that they've been followed.
And then what they do is, of course, there's a car chase. You know, when in doubt in Hollywood, have a car chase. In real life, actually, the way it works most often is you train yourself to do what is called a surveillance detection route, which is a very precise timed circuit during which you have ample opportunity to see whether or not you are being shadowed. And if so, you simply break off the route and go back to your office. The whole idea is to spot the tail, because obviously if they know that you know that they're there, they'll change their technique, and it means you've got to change your technique.
And you say the cycle would have to begin all over again.
Exactly. Exactly.
You say it, you're painting us a specific picture here of actually how the book opens, and you say your character, Sam Waterman, had spent 6 weeks crafting each segment of this particular SDR, or Surveillance detection route, even though he would end up using it only once. You go on to say he has to provide himself with a number of rabbit holes in case he had to disappear. Tell us what those, tell us just that single detail, what is involved.
Well, for example, in case officer tradecraft, for example, you use buildings that have lots of entrances and exits, because most of the time the adversarial team will be not more than half a dozen, although it could be as many as 200, 250. The Russians were known to use a cascade technique, which is hundreds of people coming at you from all directions. And the French use something called the waterfall, in which instead of following someone on their way, the watchers are coming head on, and there are just endless supplies of them. These kinds of tradecraft elements are the things that I try to get into Jack in the Box. And so, for example, if he needs a rabbit hole, there would probably have been on that SDR a department store or a multi-entrance metro stop that he could have used.
Well, and he would know that particular location very well in terms of where are the doors and where could he most easily and effectively lose himself, for instance. He would spend time researching each and every step of this route.
Absolutely, absolutely, Greg, because that is what the tradecraft is. It's not seat of your pants stuff. This is technique that is practiced, and one of the reasons that we are suffering right now are in our intelligence capabilities is that we have too few case officers with long-time street experience. Sam Waterman, the character in Jack in the Box, is a fellow who was recruited by the CIA out of Vietnam. He came back from Vietnam. He was a Marine in Vietnam, and shortly thereafter, after college, he was recruited by CIA. That means from roughly 76 or 77, he was doing this sort of thing, and he was mentored by the old generation, those guys who came out of OSS during World War II, who were terrific practitioners of tradecraft.
Hmm. You point out a couple of Sam Waterman's talents, which I imagine would be of great service and maybe all but indispensable for anyone engaging in this kind of work. I wanted to talk about a couple of them. One of them is that you talk about his extraordinary ear for languages, his ability to learn them quickly and to retain them. That's one of those sort of hidden factors that wouldn't maybe be immediately apparent to the civilian population, but a facility for language, I should think, would be one of the most important tools at an agent's disposal.
It is absolutely mission critical for a case officer. You cannot recruit spies in English. You have to recruit them in their native tongues. Case officers recruit agents. One of the things that I find most maddening is that both in newspapers and in spy fiction, the protagonists are referred to as CIA agents. A CIA agent is a foreign national who is spying on behalf of the United States. The CIA operatives are called case officers, and the case officers are the core of the Directorate of Operations, the CIA's clandestine service, and it is absolutely mission critical for these people to have language capabilities, and the problem is that too few of them today do. This stems from a time in the late 80s and early 90s during which technocrats took over. I mean, you had after Bill Casey died, you had Judge Webster followed by Bob Gates as the head of heads of CIA. Neither of these men particularly liked the art of spying, and what they did was promote from within analysts, reports officers, even secretaries into the Directorate of Operations. And unfortunately, it takes very specific kind of personality. It's a, you've got to be a people person to go out in the world, in the real world, and recruit. You have to be able to assess someone's vulnerabilities. It's part shrink, part spy, part operative, part shrewd judge of character. And you've got to be a people person to do this. Every single case officer I know, former or current, is a people person. They may not all be dashing spies like James Bond. Some of them, one of the most effective intelligence operators I've ever discovered is a man who ran operations for MI6 for many, many years in a very critical area of the world. And he is a fellow of about 5'6", and he looks like an accountant. He's got wispy white hair, and it kind of looks like George Smiley, you know, in Tinker Tailor. But this man was absolutely brilliant in his part of the world because he spoke the languages like a native. He understood the culture. He was able to go out under embassy cover and recruit spies who did the British government a lot of good.
Something else you talk about is the ability for an agent to have utter control over themselves, right down to the ability to completely mask whatever they might be thinking. If they might hear something and be immediately troubled or frightened by it, but to not betray that with even a flicker in the eyes. You talk at several points with the term opaque, or opaqueness, to describe, for instance, Sam's eyes as he's speaking with somebody to give no outward indication whatsoever that of what he's thinking, or even that he is thinking and analyzing and plotting the next step. That's also one of those gifts that would be lost on the rest of us, and not apparent probably at all.
Absolutely. And, you know, they've got to be great poker players. Literally, perhaps, as well as symbolically. You don't give anything up. I mean, if you are controlling a situation, you give nothing up. And you cannot. You cannot let your agent, for example, if you're the control officer, the case officer, you cannot let the agent do anything. You're not supposed to, for example, let the agent drive you around. You're to drive the agent. You are in control. You must make sure that you deliver to the agent instructions and make sure that the agent understands them, not the other way around. There's no room for bargaining. But having said that, at the same time, you have to do this in a way that is not bossy or overbearing, because don't forget, this is a fellow who is committing treason for you. And you've got to play them. I've always said that there are some similarities between what I did as a journalist and what case officers do. Because as a journalist, I was always trolling for sources, you know, in government and in business. And you cultivate these people and you look for their weaknesses, their vulnerabilities, and you prey on those. You know, you look at staffers on Senate committees who feel underappreciated by their bosses, or who are treated like dirt by their bosses, and you prey on that vulnerability to pry information out of them. Well, the same thing happens certainly on a much more cosmic scale for case officers. It's a people game.
We're speaking with John Weissman, and his newest book is called Jack in the Box, a Shadow War Thriller. Another thing you talk about with your character, Sam Waterman, we should say that something goes rather drastically wrong for him during one of these encounters, and he is eventually relieved of his duties. He is forced into very reluctant, albeit temporary, retirement. And during that period of retirement, when he meets up with a friend and he's just and he's in one of his favorite bars, you talk about how he still looks around a room in a way that the rest of us do not. You said he, even in retirement, he was cursed with the second sight that had come with a quarter century plus of street work. He simply saw things differently. Tell us some of the ways in which someone involved in this has to use their eyes and look about them in entirely different ways from the rest of us.
Well, you know, case officers just simply do see things differently. If you're aware of what to look for example, in Washington, I can take a walk down 23rd Street, which is outside the State Department, a main building, and I can look at marks on chalk marks on mailboxes and on fire hydrants and even on the wall, because that is where, for example, the CIA and the FBI and DIA play a denied area operations course in which teams of spies play off against teams of FBI special agents. And you're looking for marks on boxes that signify dead drops. You're looking at marks on walls that signify meeting sites. You're looking at ways to get in and out of buildings without being observed. You're looking for perhaps rabbit holes to duck into. You're looking to see how you can make your environment work for you when you're being pursued by an adversary. And all of these things are elements that most people don't ever see. And one of the goals I had with Jack in the Box was to put the reader in Sam Waterman's shoes and let readers see the world through the eyes of a case officer.
One of the themes of this book is the really frightening possibility that there are high-placed figures in the CIA who are actually working for other governments, ultimately. And we see that played out in a couple of different ways in other layers of the intelligence community, this idea of betraying one's own country for another. How often does this, in fact, occur? And to what extent can we even know how often this occurs in the real world?
Well, it occurs more often than we would like, certainly. I mean, if you go back and, you know, you have Aldrich Ames, you had Robert Hansen, you had Nicholson. There were, in the 80s, huge betrayals of American defense and intelligence technology through the Walker spy ring and various other spy rings operating right under the nose of counterintelligence. After Hansen, some of the folks I talked to within the community were convinced that Hansen was not the end of the story, that there had to be still another one or two or three moles somewhere reasonably high up in our intelligence community. And the reason for that, by the way, is that whereas the CIA basically stopped spying against the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, there was a memo sent out over the signature of the Assistant Deputy Director for Operations. This is real story now.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, saying, from here on in, we are not spying against the Russians except on a case-by-case basis. So drop all your Russian targets, take all the wiretaps off, blah, 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 blah. Well, the Russians never wrote the same memo to their people. And as you know, I mean, as late as a couple of years ago, we sent a high-ranking Russian, quote-unquote, diplomat home because somehow he had placed a bug on the sixth floor conference room of the State Department. And that in itself was a heck of a piece of tradecraft, because a Russian agent had to penetrate the State Department, had to get into a conference room, had to take photographs of the wall molding, and get paint samples so that a substitute piece of wall molding could be provided. The wall molding had to be cut out, and then the new piece inserted, a paint job had to be put on, and it had to look exactly as it did beforehand.
Hmm.
Now, that to me is terrific tradecraft. I mean, don't you wish we had agents as well-placed in Saddam Hussein's inner circle in Baghdad to have been able to place a mic in, you know, Saddam Hussein's basement rec room or one of his palaces where he hung out with his chiefs of intelligence? This is something that cannot be done by satellites. It cannot be done by remote control. You need people to do that sort of thing.
One of the things that is also talked about in your book to help us understand the mindset of those that engage in this work is when you talk at various points about coincidence and how for many people that work in intelligence, there is no such thing as coincidence. There is no such thing as taking things at face value, that one has to experience everything around you in a whole different way, and looking for patterns where they might not immediately be apparent. That cannot be an easy thing, because, of course, sometimes in life there are, in fact, coincidences. So to what extent are you suspicious of coincidences and yet accepting of the fact that not every apparent coincidence is actually a hidden conspiracy or something else fraught with all kinds of meaning and significance?
Well, one element of that is experience, which is why we're in such bad shape now, because there are too few case officers with 25-plus years of street experience who factor in all sorts of prior experiences to see whether or not this is real or if it's Memorex. And, of course, the other thing is that old saying, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I think that we have to be very careful as we look at situations not to repeat our errors. I mean, we should learn. One of the things that the intelligence community is a lot slower about than, for example, the military, is lessons learned from mistakes. Whether it's because of poor leadership or whether it's because of the culture over there, they tend to be slower to change because of the mistakes made. And, you know, who knows why? That's something that I could spend the next 10 books writing about.
Hmm. One of the things that's interesting about Jack in the Box is that there is a fair amount of intersection with the real world. That is, you evoke names like President Bill Clinton and President George W. Bush and Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. So there is an intriguing mix here of fiction and nonfiction. You talk about 9/11. You talk about the Cold War. So you have not fashioned an entirely fictional landscape here. Talk for us for a moment about that decision as an author to do that, and the way in which that was maybe a tricky thing to handle.
Well, I decided early on that I wanted to set this more or less in real time, in a real situation, because it would add not only verisimilitude to the book, but it would be a huge challenge, I mean, to try and set it this way, and to use real people. I mean, Edward Lee Howard, the only CIA officer ever to defect to the KGB to Moscow, is a real person. And in Jack in the Box, in a novel, he dies exactly the way he died in real life, a fall down the stairs of his dacha outside Moscow. Rem Kirillnikov, the famous KGB spy hunter, is a real character. And it was challenging for me to set these fictional people into a real world time frame, because it gave them urgency. They did actually have to act and react within a certain real time frame of October of 2002 to the end of 2002.
You make an interesting choice in the pages of this book for certain spots in the text to be blacked out, as we sometimes see on the news when a highly classified document, for instance, is shown to the world, but with certain words or sometimes even entire sentences blocked out so they cannot be read. And as we read through Jack in the Box, we find those moments here as well.
There's a board that reads all Central Intelligence Agency employee publications. If you're going to publish a book, it is called the Publications Review Board at the CIA. And when I wrote Shadow Warrior, which was the life story of Felix Rodriguez, who was a CIA agent, not a case officer, but an agent, until he became an American citizen, who was largely responsible for the capture of Che Guevara in Bolivia in 1957. We had to, because of Felix's employment at the CIA, submit our manuscript for approval by this Publications Review Board. And we had the choice of publishing with redactions or just taking the 200 or so words in this manuscript that they said compromised sources and methods out. We chose just to take them out. In Jack in the Box, I thought it might be fun to give the reader a sense of what happens when a CIA case officer writes a book. For example, if you look at Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, Baer was a 21-year veteran case officer, Middle East specialist. And if you look at his book, See No Evil, or his later book, Sleeping with the Devil, you will see redactions there. And I thought, since this is lies like truth, and that some fiction, some truth can be told best in fiction, I'd use that little literary conceit in Jack in the Box.
Very good. Well, as we follow Sam Waterman's adventures and a couple of misadventures as well, as he tries to unravel just who is still loyal to the United States and who is being a traitor. It occurs to me that this is an immensely entertaining book, and yet you are touching on something which is such a serious matter, and for many people of very, very urgent concern. Is that a worry to you at all, that you are generating something entertaining out of something which really has actually very, the possibility at least, of very frightening ramifications for our country?
You know, I think that there are writers who work in the same area I do, who are masters of this craft. Charles McCarry is one. I mean, the early Le Carre stuff is just spellbinding. And what I hope to do is to give readers a sense of the real world, but to make it as entertaining as possible, because you can't bulldoze anybody into reading your book. They have to be hooked on it, you know? And if they put it down after 10 pages, it does nobody any good, certainly not when my next book comes out. So you try and do both. You try and tell the truth, and you also try and make it as entertaining as you can. And I'm delighted. I mean, I'm truly, truly delighted, Greg, that you found it that way.
I did. And I think that ultimately there's perhaps good that can be done from a book like this besides entertaining a reader, and that is maybe the possibility that it will get some of the American public to think differently about intelligence work and the importance of it for us.
I hope so. I mean, I think that you cannot have false expectations. When I listen to the 9/11 Commission open hearings, I am astounded by what the commissioners expect of our intelligence community. It's almost as if they've done nothing but read Tom Clancy for 20 years, in which the CIA never fails, you know, and the good guys always win, and everything is wrapped up neatly at the end. And life is not like that.
Certainly not in the pages of this book.
Well, I thank you for that.
The book, again, is called Jack in the Box, a Shadow War Thriller, published by William Morrow and the author, John Wiseman. John Wiseman, a great pleasure to read this book and to talk with you about it today on The Morning Show. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your thorough reading.